The Senate approved an additional $3 billion for so-called border security last week, most of which will be used to build some 700 miles of fencing in an attempt to keep migrants from crossing. Lawmakers voted 95-1 to add the funds to a nearly $500 billion defense bill. Meanwhile, more than 1,300 people have been arrested by ICE officials in Southern California in the past 2 weeks, which authorities say was one of the largest actions the agency has ever taken. And while mainstream media called the raids a crackdown on so-called criminal aliens, about one-third of those arrested had no criminal record whatsoever. Nearly half of those arrested by ICE have already been deported. These latest raids are an extension of an increasingly visible attack on immigrants. We're joined in studio by Roberto Lovato. He's a writer with New American Media, a frequent contributor to The Nation, and the former head of Carecen here in Los Angeles. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi.
Now, I want to talk to you about the historical context in which this is happening. We talk a little bit about the 90s, the 80s, but I know that you talk a lot about the Palmer raids. Can we go back to that point in history and talk about some of the comparisons between then and now?
Yeah, I've taken to history of late in order to understand what's happening right now as far as the raids, because it's hard to explain why the raids, even after the elections, are continuing. Most people explain the raids by saying it's electoral, that it's a wedge issue, and I severely doubt that. It's not just a wedge issue. It's something above and beyond a wedge issue that deals with, I think, profounder issues that have to do with the crisis of the state and the legitimacy of the state itself and the need for the state to build its infrastructure, in this case, its military infrastructure, within the borders of the United States. So in trying to find a parallel to the raids, I went and I found the Palmer raids.
And those happened about almost 100 years ago.
No, the Palmer raids happened around 1920. And prior to that, there was a major crisis. Again, I really think we need to look at crisis, because the crisis back then was that people were coming back from World War One, and there were no jobs. It was, you know, we were ramping up for the Great Depression. And so some people recognized this, and they saw the opportunity in the uprising of 4 million workers, mostly immigrant workers, that rose up to do 3,600 strikes in the year 1919 alone. And so you have immigrant workers advocating for their rights, and then you have the response of the state by Mitchell Palmer, but more importantly, by a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, who founded the FBI on the excuse of, you know, protecting the national security of the country against these immigrant and, you know, commies and anarcho-syndicalists, et cetera. And so there was a lot of money spent to build up the bureaucracy. And if you look at U.S. history, there's a pattern of immigrant uprisings, like, say, during the Alien and Sedition Act, the Whiskey Rebellion, the Fries Rebellion. They were immigrant-led. Again, the state uses them as an excuse to build up its bureaucracy and infrastructure. We have, not long after these rebellions, you have the birth of the Department of War, and you have exponential increases in government expenses on military based on the fear of immigrants. And so I think that what's behind the raids is not just the need to control immigrants, and it's not even just about the immigrants. It's about the state as much as it is about the immigrants.
Now let's talk about some of the parallels. Back then it was just post-war. Right now we're not post-war yet, unfortunately, but people are sort of, you know, coming back and forth from Iraq. We see an economy that's facing some serious issues, especially up against the euro. What are some of the parallels you see between something like the Palmer raids and what's going on now?
Well, I think we need to look both domestically and geopolitically. And the U.S. was trying to reorganize its economic structure and the political structure to support the enrichment of those few people back at that time. And so we have something similar. There's a restructuring happening, and the restructuring is markedly different in terms of the history of the nation state. At that time, the nation state was being more consolidated. Right now, the nation state's under severe pressure right now. If you look at the fact that global trade, economic transactions, communications, transnational drug networks, transnational networks and circuits of all kinds are really, or for example, organizations like Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, kind of doing things that nation states used to do, transnational organizations. The role of the state is kind of in play, in flux. There's no more welfare state. And so what's left of the American dream, according to a poll by Celinda Lake, 18% of people in the United States believe, only 18% believe that they have the American dream. And so if you're the elites looking at what's happening in this country, the severe crisis, economic crisis, and the political crisis brought on by the selection of George Bush, then you need to figure out how to manage and control the increasingly empty shell of the state. And so immigrants provide a means for a state that has problems of legitimacy to reinforce the idea of itself by building bureaucracy, by sending the military to the border, by having a criminal other that allows it, you know, that the criminal immigrant other in their illegitimacy would reinforce the legitimacy of the state.
Of the state, right. So we've talked a little bit about what the state is doing then, what the state is doing now. Let's move on to how people are responding now, the good ways, the ways that might be improved, a little bit about strategies, obstacles that we face.
Well, I think that there's you can't say there's any one way that people are responding because there's the immigrant rights movement is so massive and large, it can't be mapped yet. It can't be mapped. It's still the immigrant rights movement is in flux. The discourse of the immigrant rights movement is one of that it's monotone and that it's singular and that it's based in Washington and that it's negotiating with Kennedy and with the Republicans. When, you know, we know that reality is a little different. The movement is massive and large and it continues. And it was around long before Sensenbrenner. As far back as 68, I would trace it, say, with CASA here in L.A. And so there are different tactics and strategies. And I tried to look into history right now because I think there's a need for a deeper analysis of the problem. And the problem is not the immigrant. The problem is the state and the problems of the state. And it's not just about controlling workers. There's something else going on. And so we see I think the lack of analysis in the way that the immigrant rights movement has allowed itself largely to remain in a defensive, even reactionary posture, reactionary right wing, but reactionary in terms of reacting to the advances of the state, the raids, stop the raids, or the Minutemen, and really you don't create too much political space from a defensive posture. You need to defend against these heinous acts, but I would argue that there's a need to open up new flanks in the movement. And so in order to do that, for example, I've started writing about the need to do things to pull out of the defensive, the need to complement the sanctuary movement, which came out of the Central America sanctuary movement, which I was a part of. What we're lacking still was something we had during the sanctuary movement, because we had sanctuary, but there was also the solidarity movement, which was kind of the more militant arm of Central American strategy. And, you know, somebody needs to take time to think through the strategy that's going to take the onus off of the backs of immigrants and onto the state. I would argue onto ICE. So, for example, tactically, rather than go and get a million people to march in the streets, you only need 3,000 mostly citizens, say Anglos and students like we had with CISPES and other organizations, and surround ICE, close their offices, draw media attention to the fact that ICE is not a credible force. We have a U.S. populace that's conditioned to see people in uniform as heroes, be they in Iraq, be they within the borders of the United States. We need to crack that egg. We need to make the yolk fall out of ICE and show them for the putrid force that they are. In the absence of that, you will have the continued demonization of the immigrant, which is a default position. And so that's one thing. Another thing would be, for example, somebody needs to pay for what they're doing. Somebody needs to get scared. And I think corporate America needs to get scared. During Proposition 187, when we were doing the organizing around that, we came very close to launching a transnational boycott and actually sending organizers to Latin America. We had identified a company that filled certain criteria, like a supporter of Pete Wilson and the Republican Party, had investments and interests in the Latino market, both in the United States and in America Latina, and that would be vulnerable to pressure from us. So there are companies out there that are heavily invested in the Latino market here, that are heavily invested in America Latina. So why not agree on one company and really, really hurt that company for what it's doing by supporting these raids and the bureaucrats and the elected officials that are carrying out what I would argue is state terrorism. And let me explain that, because it's a loaded term.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Roberto Lovato. He's a writer with New American Media and a frequent contributor to The Nation. He's also the former head of Carecen here in Los Angeles. You were just talking about how these raids are a form of state terrorism.
Yeah, I've been traveling the country for the last 4 years researching a book I'm trying to do. And I've come across a lot of people like Justine Mancha in Reedville, Georgia, who was coming out of the shower half naked when six heavily armed ICE agents came in and shoved their guns in her face, scaring her. And I interviewed, I've spoken with Justine, and Justine arms started twitching. You know, her arms twitch. Her dreams are filled with men in uniform persecuting her, men with uniforms and guns. Now, where have I seen this before? Yes, in El Salvador. And so if you look at what the definition of terrorism is, it's the use of violence to advance a certain political agenda. Clearly, the body of Justine Mancha, the bodies of so many immigrants, reflect serious trauma and terror. And so we haven't really – some folks are really framing it that way, but I think we need to ramp it up, because the inability to humanize and discuss the human component of what is actually happening to people allows for these actions to continue. In order to be violent, be it verbally violent, be it physically violent, you need to take away the humanity. And the state knows this very well. We don't live in an age where it's government propaganda. It's private sector propaganda. So private sector propaganda on immigrants facilitates the violence against immigrants. And so the strategy to combat these kinds of things needs to take on the media itself. And so I've been trying to think through and write about how the framing of immigrants as criminals and all this is very damaging. How we need, for example, to make the illegal alien term our N-word. That term needs to be absolutely not acceptable in public and rational discourse. So some advocates, be they media advocates, be they immigrant rights advocates, should consider going and meeting with the editorial boards, launch a national campaign to make that the N-word, make it so that anybody that says that is absolutely condemned as a racist. We don't do that. The African American community has a lot more political clarity and more history. We're still kind of ramping up, and our movement is historic. But still, there's a need to get off of the defensive. And so you can do this verbally. You can do this economically. You do this in the media. And speaking of the African American community, we need to be very aggressive in building real alliances, not just kind of, hey, come to our marches kind of things.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and there's so much more that I want to talk to you about, but I do want to approach quickly one last thing. You were talking about building solidarity and creating solidarity, kind of a front group of people that can also be proactive to sort of put the pressure off the people that really aren't documented and the people that might be second generation. What do you think is a good first step towards doing that?
First step is the analysis. We need to understand why we're doing this. Another step would be during the Central America Solidarity Days, what was done was that human beings that were also refugees went out and gave their testimony to churches and used the human contact to humanize and move the issue and move people to action. And so I think that good old-fashioned stuff like that can help get citizens, be they Anglo, be they U.S.-born Latinos or others, to act forward. And I just last thing I would like to say was that there's also, and there is a lot of vision out there in the community to look at the issue beyond the borders of the United States, because it's a quintessentially transnational, beyond the borders of the U.S. And I would argue that the degree to which we allow ourselves to frame and act on the immigration issue within the borders of the United States, to the exclusion of trade, military policy, like in Colombia, $3-4 billion, is the degree to which we lose the debate and don't allow ourselves to have a vision that extends far beyond electoral politics, legalizations, and the borders of the United States.
Roberto Lovato, thank you so much for joining us in studio today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Roberto Lovato. He's a writer with New American Media and a frequent contributor to The Nation. He's also the former head of Carecen here in L.A.